I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Yesterday, Emmanuel Macron trounced the populist far-right candidate Marine Le Pen to become France's next president. The election was a blowout and the latest in a string of repudiations of anti-immigrant candidates in Europe. So why have voters in France, the Netherlands, and Austria rejected populist candidates while voters in the United States embrace the xenophobia of Donald Trump? The authors of a new book about the 2016 presidential election argue that the answer is in part Hillary Clinton. Few candidates in history had the kind of political pedigree that the former Secretary of State brought to the race, but she was unable to overcome chronic and implacable voter distrust. Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes join me today to talk woulda, shoulda, and coulda in presidential politics. Their new book is called Shattered, Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. First, the news. Hey, good afternoon, everybody. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Hope you had a good weekend and very glad that you've chosen to join us this afternoon. The result of the 2016 presidential race was a surprise to many people, pundits, pollsters, Democrats, and many Republicans, perhaps even the Republican who won. It was most certainly a surprise to the Democrat who lost, whose team went into Election Day nervous but still confident that they'd win the race that most polls showed had tightened in the final days, but not so much as to predict a Trump victory. Well, if you read a new book by two veteran Washington reporters, you'd almost be hard-pressed to find any reason that Hillary Clinton could have won, given the infighting in her campaign and a host of strategic and operational mistakes made over the course of the primaries and the general election. The FBI, the Russians, and WikiLeaks may have had a hand in throwing the election to Donald Trump, but Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes argue that it was Hillary Clinton herself and her ineffective team that did the most damage. Their book is reported using sources that are almost always unidentified, and their assessment in large measure echoes that of other observers. It's a fascinating recap of the campaign and its many twists and turns. It's called Shattered, Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. Jonathan Allen is the head of community and content for Sidewire and a columnist for Roll Call. He joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Jonathan, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
And Amy Parnes is the senior White House correspondent for The Hill newspaper. She joins us from WGBO Radio in Newark, New Jersey. Amy, welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Tom.
So, Amy, let me start with you. When did you all start covering Secretary Clinton in her bid for the White House?
So John and I had both covered her bid in 2008. We then wrote a book called HRC about Secretary Clinton's tenure at the State Department. And then this was sort of the sequel to HRC, this book Shattered, that sort of answers the questions we laid out. We looked at her time in governance. We wanted to know if she learned her lessons from 2008, which our book kind of touched on as well. And so this was sort of a look at answering all those questions that we had raised in our original book.
And John, did you have a particular deal with the Clinton campaign in terms of access and in terms of who you could talk to, when you could talk to them, and when you could reveal what they told you?
It's interesting. We never really had a deal in place with the campaign as such, but we definitely communicated with people on the campaign. You know, worked with them some to get some of the interviews that we had, went around them to get some of the interviews that we had. The agreements, though, were specific to individuals rather than some broader agreement with the campaign itself. And the main components there are we promised people that we would not release any of the information that we got before the end of the election because we knew people wouldn't be honest with us about what was going on if they felt like it might negatively impact Secretary Clinton. And then the other piece was we granted anonymity to our sources because some of them, most of them would have feared some sort of retribution, recrimination, or simply potentially looking bad with their names attached to things. So Those two things were very helpful in terms of getting people to talk to us during the campaign and also getting them to be as frank as possible.
And Amy Parnes, that really was a requisite, you think, to get people to speak candidly and openly, granting them anonymity so that, you know, if they were – many of these folks are political creatures. If they wanted to join other campaigns post this one or, you know, stay in this in the business, it was going to be detrimental to that effort if they were on the record in most cases.
Yes, definitely. I think many of them, as you said, are political creatures, and they had worked on campaigns, and they plan to work on campaigns, and they have friends who were at the White House and elsewhere, and I think that definitely helped them. And, you know, Clinton world, I should say, is a tough nut to crack if you talk to people without that kind of anonymity. And so I think this definitely helped us tell the most candid story.
And John, given what happened yesterday in France, where Marine Le Pen, a populist like Donald Trump, was roundly got her, as George Bush might say, her clock cleaned, losing 66-34 in that election. Do you draw any parallels between the populist who lost so badly in France and the populist who won fairly narrowly here in the United States?
Sure. I think there's been a wave of populism across the globe, particularly in Europe. We saw Brexit as an early indicator of that. The American election showed that with the support Bernie Sanders had from liberals who wanted to pull back a little bit from the world, and Donald Trump obviously winning the presidency in the Republican primary in a party that not too long ago was pretty globalist. But, you know, each candidate in each country is a little different. I don't think that Donald Trump's politics and Marine Le Pen's exactly match up. Certainly the French electorate and the American electorate don't exactly match up. The issues are a little bit different. But I think, you know, it's clear that there's been a move toward populism. And I think what we saw in France yesterday was the world putting the brakes on a little bit.
And Amy, I read your book carefully, and it was fascinating. It was compelling.
Thank you.
A political junkie, I mean, you know, anybody who's a political junkie is going to like this. It's kind of full of a lot of juicy gossip. It's got all sorts of insights into obviously a story that we knew from the beginning how it was going to end. But you write right at the very beginning of the book that it was a spirit-crushing campaign. You quote Jennifer Palmieri, top Clinton aide, as saying that, quote, we are not allowed to have nice things. It seems like right from the very get-go, this campaign had a sort of cloud over it.
Yes, that's right. That cloud came with the email controversy that kind of hung over the campaign for the first 6 months. Even before Secretary Clinton announced her bid for the presidency, she was dealing with this controversy. You might recall a month out, she called a press conference and issued a statement about the controversy, and it kind of plagued her until early that fall, when she finally took, in a couple of attempts, apologized. But I think, you know, the message was the aides around her were having difficulty kind of cutting through that looming controversy, and the message was being clouded. They couldn't really get that across, and there was some frustration building because I think Secretary Clinton and President Clinton actually didn't want to apologize at first and didn't feel the need to. They felt like they had done nothing wrong. At the same time, you had senior advisors kind of trying to pull them in that direction and try to explain that that was necessary, that an apology could actually help them move forward. So I think all of that kind of contributed to not the best start to that campaign.
And John Allen, I mean, is there evidence that an apology early on, if Mr. Clinton and his wife, the candidate, Secretary Clinton, had been convinced that sort of abject apology right out of the gate would have been a good strategy. Is there any evidence that that would have worked? I mean, this story just kept having legs for the entire time. And as you remind us in the book, and I'd forgotten, this email story started before she even announced her campaign. It was there for every second of this contest.
Right up until the time James Comey came out and said that he was reopening the investigation in late October, and then came out and said that he had found nothing new just a couple days before the election. So it really spanned the entirety of the election. As to whether there's evidence that it would have been less painful for her had she made an apology more immediately, that's sort of like the question of whether a different shortstop would have made the same error that the guy playing made. I mean, it's impossible to know. But I would say this. She suffered tremendous damage over the course of about 6 months in 2015 to her credibility, not just with Republicans and independents, but with Democratic voters. You saw her trust and honesty numbers just plummet from where they had been over the course of that summer. And it's hard to think that the drumbeat of the email scandal every day, of this scandal that basically related to her trying to, or at least effectively hiding her her email from the public, her correspondence that's supposed to be available through Freedom of Information requests. It's hard to see how that didn't have a strong correlation with the drop-off in people's view of her honesty.
But it also, Amy, seems to me to be equally hard to see how if she had apologized for it, that would have changed much, because we still would have had Comey and his investigation and his non-investigation and reopening the investigation 11 days before the vote. I'm just not sure an apology by the candidate would have moved that needle one way or the other than folks would have said, oh, well, she's recognized that this was a mistake. But it's interesting. One of the bits of, and I call it gossip, and pardon me, because I'm sure you guys call it reporting. but you talked about how Secretary Clinton, to critique her own campaign in 2008, instructed an aide to download the emails of some of her top aides back in 2008, essentially snooping on them a little bit to find out what they were talking about during that campaign to see what lessons she might learn.
Yeah, that's right. This was part of a broader autopsy that she performed to kind of find out what had happened in 2008 and what she might be able to do better going forward should she run again. And she, as part of that, invited aides into her office to kind of talk about it. And then, yes, she did actually go and ask a couple of aides to look into emails and see who was leaking what. And ultimately, I think that had some consequences because she determined that several people were leaking, several people who wanted to be on her campaign, one specifically. And I think that actually ultimately hurt this one candidate, this one who was probably up for her campaign manager slot. So I think that, yeah, she really wanted to find out what was what. The 2008 campaign had been disastrous for her. There was a slew of leaking and lots of internal turmoil splashed onto the pages of newspapers and the cable networks. And I think she wanted to prevent that from happening again.
Some of what happened in this campaign, John, is kind of the gang that couldn't shoot straight stuff. At one point, you tell a story about how Jennifer Palmieri asked Huma Abedin, who was a very close aide to Secretary Clinton, to find out what particular person on TV Secretary Clinton wanted to have to do an interview about the emails. And Abedin told Palmieri, Biana, meaning Biana Golodryga, I guess, or Golodryga of Yahoo News. But Huma evidently said Brianna instead of Biana, and it got confused and ended up sending the interview to Brianna Kyler of CNN, perhaps a less a less accommodating interlocutor. Were those kinds of things commonplace? I mean, just really silly, unforced errors?
I mean, you know, that one in particular, I think, is more farcical than some of the other errors in the campaign. That said, Hillary Clinton ended up with a really tough interview with Brianna Kilar. That I think pretty much everyone who watched it thought Clinton really did poorly. Her own staff said she was staring daggers at Brianna the whole time. I would want just if I could for one moment. You brought up earlier the Clinton instructing her her aides to download messages, email messages after the 2008 campaign, and you brought up the difference between gossip and reporting, and I just wanted to make clear that we don't think of that as gossip at all.
Sure,
that's reporting, and we think there's you know, a lot of really new and interesting information in this book that helps people understand not just the campaign itself, but also Hillary Clinton. And some of that stuff is, you know, I think it depends on who's reading it and at what moment. But, you know, I think some of that stuff is, you know, very positive for Hillary Clinton. Some of it is negative for Hillary Clinton. But I think, you know, I think her humanity actually bleeds through this book. And you see, you know, strengths and weaknesses. And sometimes those strengths and weaknesses are contained within the same characteristics. So I really, you know, I think this is a really three-dimensional look at a candidate who sometimes had difficulty giving voters that three-dimensional view of her.
And I would agree with that assessment completely, and I use the gossip playfully, the term gossip playfully. This book is chock full of really interesting, fascinating reporting, and a bunch of it brand new, at least to me, that's for sure. So we're going to come back after a break. Amy Parnes and Jonathan Allen, their new book is called Shattered: Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. You are welcome to join our conversation when we return. 410-662-8780, our email address, midday@wipr.org. You can follow us on Twitter at midday. Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Stick around.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR, where you're listening to Midday.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, a conversation about internet privacy with Furman de Brabander. He's a professor of philosophy at the Maryland Institute College of Art. Avi Rubin, professor of computer science and technical director of the Information Security Institute at Johns Hopkins University. And Melanie Teplinski, she's a law professor at American University. So what does the law say about what we're allowed to keep private and what we do to keep our information private, or in some cases, very unprivate? Folks are into oversharing in our society. We'll talk about all of that tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guests are Amy Parnes, the senior White House correspondent for The Hill newspaper, and Jonathan Allen, the head of community and content for Sidewire and a columnist for Roll Call. We're talking woulda, coulda, shoulda in the campaign for president last year. The new book is called Shattered: Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. You are welcome to join our conversation at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and if you'd like to follow us on Twitter, at Midday Tom Hall. So, Amy, you talk about the difficulty that the Clinton campaign had coming up with a coherent and compelling message. You say that they never had any sort of overarching narrative to explain her candidacy. But I wonder, was Mr. Trump's message of Make America Great Again, was that an overarching narrative? I mean, were the Clintons looking for something like that, or were they looking for something different?
I think they, well, they should have been looking for something kind of simple. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, if you go outside and you ask someone what Trump stood for, they will throw that back at you and they'll say, yeah, he wanted to make America great again. They know that he wanted to build a wall. They know basically what he stood for. I think she was, from the beginning, all over the map on, you know, her diehard supporters kind of knew what she stood for, but a lot of people didn't, particularly independents. And there was a wall that John and I often talk about in her Brooklyn headquarters that said Hillary is for. And there were post-it notes all over the place and with various policy ideas. And people often noted to us, if you're for everything, you're for nothing. And she had a hard time struggling. You know, from the very beginning, when she gave that speech at Roosevelt Island, she had called in a bunch of advisors, outside advisors, inside advisors, pollsters to kind of go over what that message should be, what that speech should look like. And right there from that very start. She was struggling with what she should say. She even brought in an Obama advisor, Obama speechwriter, who basically was so frustrated by the process that he didn't really complete it and left early and said, you know, he was used to dealing with President Obama and maybe one advisor on the issue on a speech and felt like it was there were too many cooks in the kitchen. And a lot of people said internally that anyone, any Democrat could have given that speech, the one that she gave at Roosevelt Island, that it was just your typical Democratic stump speech and it wasn't really personalized to her. And I think that ultimately hurt her. Her messages range from, you know, in the beginning it was breaking barriers, I'm with her. Toward the end, I think the campaign felt satisfied with Stronger Together, and that was probably her best message throughout the campaign. But they were constantly looking for, you know, an overarching message, a big idea kind of thing.
And John, if I could build on that for just a second, I think that's a perfect example of a characteristic that is both a strength and a weakness. This obsession with policy details, it's something that Hillary Clinton's fans love her for. She's somebody who really is an expert on all kinds of public policy and spends a lot of time trying to figure out where exactly each piece of policy should be moved. And at the same time, as a political candidate, it can be a weakness to not be able to or not be willing to prioritize certain things or take a black or white stance on an issue, say on trade, on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. She would explain under what conditions she could support something like that, even if she said she was against it, whereas you had Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump just saying no, 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 no. So, you know, that policy expertise and that unwillingness to really sort of make the more politically expedient argument is something that her fans really love about her. And at the same time, I think it made it difficult on the campaign trail to appeal to voters who may not have been paying quite as much attention to those details.
And we have a long line of folks who want to talk to you on the phone. But before we go to those phones, Amy, you write at one point that she was at her wit's end, this is Secretary Clinton, about messaging, and she blamed her staff for not having one. I mean, is it the responsibility of a staff to have a message for a candidacy and a rationale for being president?
No, I think it ultimately falls at the feet of the candidate. I mean, you can hire the best staff, and I believe she had really good staffers around her. You had people from the Obama campaign who came over, and you had the best of you had really good folks from her previous campaign and other walks of life in the Democratic Party. And I think ultimately, I think she needed to kind of figure out why. She had basically 8 years to come up with a message and figure out why it is she was running. But I think inevitably, and I think even her staunch supporters admit at this point, she became the inevitable candidate, and she didn't really give people a reason for why she was running.
And John, when it comes to a rationale, what does it say about our political discourse and our political system where we have a situation where here's a candidate whose experience, whose temperament, and whose expertise in public policy was not sufficient as a rationale for being president?
Yeah, I think, you know, it is difficult. This is a candidate who in 2008 also sort of ran on resume, or at least ended up essentially running on resume in 2008 against former and not yet President Obama.
We remember that guy, yeah.
Right. But when she ran against him, she ended up getting sort of boxed into a place where he was the candidate of change and she was the status quo. I think that happened again both in the primary and the general election this time. And I think part of that was her talking in the tones of a Washington insider at a time of desire for outsider candidates and change. It's interesting that both of the last two open seat elections really were change elections. And I think voters always want to know where it is you're going to take the country. What is unique about you as a candidate and your platform that will change America for the better for each voter and sort of on the whole? And it just, I think she just sort of got pinned down in the weeds and sounded a lot like a Washington insider.
Let's go to the phones. And folks, we do have a lot of folks who would like to speak with John Allen and Amy Parnes. So I ask that you keep your comments brief and you make your question early on in your discourse. Ellen in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, hi. Listen, I think that you're discussing the Clinton candidacy without the context of the Obama presidency. And, you know, he ran on hope and change. Sarah Palin made the remark, you know, how's the hopey-changey thing working out for you? And he had a coherent and compelling message that he didn't follow through on. People, you know, so a lot of the Obama voters ended up voting for Trump because it didn't matter how coherent and compelling her message would have been. It would have been heard in the context of his failure to live up to the hope change, narrative that he had put forward people really believed in.
Yeah, well, thanks for that call. And Amy, it is kind of fascinating to think that there were so many people who did support Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012, and they switched to Donald Trump, which seems like a complete ideological shift. But, you know, more than one voter did that.
Yeah, it's true. A lot of people who voted for her in 2008, she kind of lost a lot of those people, the white working class, and that was something that I think Bill Clinton saw pretty early on, and he kind of flagged this for the campaign and basically said, you know, I'm getting a different feel on the ground. We should be speaking to these people who supported us. Why are we just going after people who voted for President Obama, particularly in cities? We should be, you know, you guys should be sending me to X, Y, and Z places. And he was getting pushback from the campaign. And I think that was problematic for them ultimately.
Let's go back to another caller, Mark in Catonsville. Welcome to Midday with John Allen and Amy Parnes.
Hi there. Thanks for taking the call. First of all, I want to make a general point that I think it's a little unseemly to blame Hillary for everything, which is what a lot of people are doing. A lot of people I know, a lot of Democrats, particularly, of course, Bernie folks. She paid the ultimate price, and I think we need to remember that. And I think her biggest failing, and you're talking basically a failure of salesmanship, that's what you're talking about. Nobody's saying her policies were wrong. She wasn't a good salesman, and that's because basically she was telling the truth. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find any major lies in her programs, what she proposed, what they would cost, et cetera. Whereas Trump said anything, and we're seeing that now, that a lot of what he said was not true, and that's a tremendous advantage.
Well, thanks for the call. And, John, you write about how particularly during the debates – Mr. Trump could seem authentic while telling things that were untrue, saying things that were untrue, while Secretary Clinton appeared to be lying about things that, in fact, were true. It was a bizarre dichotomy, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think there was just a tremendous style clash there and sort of the way they talked. And, you know, that's, again, that's style and not substance. And I think the caller makes a really good point there. I mean, this book is not making a value judgment about whether Hillary Clinton has the right values or the wrong values, or Donald Trump had the right values or the wrong values. Just reporting on what happened, I think we take readers through the campaign, the highs and the lows, and certainly the devastating for Democrats night of the election in sort of painstaking detail. And I think we analyze what worked and what didn't. But I think the caller is right, and we say this in the book. Clinton's focus on public policy and the details of public policy included a real attempt, and I think she successfully pulled this off, to be very serious about how you pay for things when you create a program, what economic growth you can anticipate, and what that means for how much revenue there will be. You know, the sort of things that candidates often don't do, I think, mattered a lot to her. And in terms of, you know, the honesty about policy, you can always look at somebody's program and say it's more or less realistic. But, you know, if you tracked her through the course of the campaign, you really didn't see her change her policy a whole lot. Occasionally by degree, certainly, you know, after the Democratic nomination process, I think, you know, the party platform moved a little bit to the left of where she'd been, you know, as a candidate in the primary. But you weren't seeing wholesale changes from her to try to win over sort of pieces of the electorate. You know, you can point to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but her position in the campaign was consistent on that, even though she had negotiated for it before the campaign and then came out against it. That's really the big one when you look at, changes in her policy. So I think the caller's got a good point there.
Ray in Baltimore, you bring up a point about the influence or the impact and importance in this race of Bernie Sanders. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'd like to get your panel's take on the fact that I think that Bernie Sanders undercut Hillary Clinton. He criticized her every day in every way, and I think that had an impact on her bid for an election.
Thanks for your comment, Ray. And Amy, you write about how the Clinton campaign was pretty slow to understand the rise of Bernie Sanders. They didn't take him seriously early enough, perhaps.
Yeah, I think Secretary Clinton did, actually, and we report that in the book. She was taking him seriously from the beginning and thought that he would pose a bigger threat than Martin O'Malley. But I think, you know, particularly as the campaign wore on, basically, in the primary, the leading in January of 2016 into the Iowa caucus and the New Hampshire primary, they started seeing him creep up in the polls, and he was right at their backs unexpectedly. And suddenly, people started writing, "Uh-oh, is he the storylines?" Basically, saying, "Is he the next Barack Obama? Did the Clinton campaign never see this coming?" And that kind of threw them for a loop, and they finally tried to get serious about it. And but I think he did. I think a lot of people felt like he did actually hurt the campaign towards the end when he was really hammering her home for, speaking to big banks and for looking out for big banks. And at the same time, Donald Trump and other Republicans were basically saying, yeah, he was calling her crooked Hillary. And so that definitely left a dent in her narrative, I think, going forward. And a lot of those Democrats never came home and they never supported her ultimately. And I think that was a problem, that the fact that she couldn't quite seal the deal and convince people that, you know, that narrative that Bernie Sanders was talking about towards the end of the primary, that wasn't true. So these were all factors. And yes, I think Bernie Sanders was a tremendous factor.
Amy Parnes, along with Jonathan Allen, she's the author of a new book on the Clinton campaign called Shattered Inside, Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. We'll have more with these two veteran Washington reporters when we return. You're welcome to join our conversation then. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. You can follow us on Twitter, and we certainly hope you will, @MiddayTomHall. It is our practice here on Midday on Mondays to stand in sympathy with the families of people who have lost their lives in homicides in our city. So far this year, 119 people in Baltimore City have been killed. Last week, 10 people were the victims of homicide in Baltimore. They are Ashley Long, age 29, Larry Lawson, age 29, Edgar Powers, age 35, Darian Singleton, age 23, D'Artagnan Tibbs, age 19, Donald Holbrook, age 25, Kevin Watkins, age 30, Charles Frazier, age 39, Tyrell Matthews, age 24, and Stephen Jackson. He was just 18 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
It wasn't a perfect campaign. There is no such thing. But I was on the way to winning until the combination of Jim Comey's letter on October 28th and Russian WikiLeaks raised doubts in the minds of people who were inclined to vote for me but got scared off. We overcame a lot in the campaign. We overcame an enormous barrage of negativity, of false equivalency, and so much else. But as Nate Silver, who doesn't work for me, he's an independent analyst, but one considered to be very reliable, has concluded, if the election had been on October 27th, I'd be your president.
Hillary Clinton speaking last week at the Women to Women International Conference in New York City. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking about a book that is among the first of what is sure to be many postmortems on the 2016 presidential campaign. It's called Shattered, Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. The authors are Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes, who join me on the line from Washington, D.C. and Newark, New Jersey, respectively. You are welcome to join us as well. 410-662 is our phone number. Sorry, 410-662-8780. I guess you have to have all 10 digits there to make it a real phone number. 410-662-8780. That's the number. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. So, John Allen, what do you think of Mrs. Clinton's argument that had the election been earlier, she would have won it? Certainly going into election night, her entire staff, it seemed, from your reporting, were pretty confident that she would win. But she makes an interesting comment in this clip we just heard from her conversation with Christiane Amanpour. She said, folks who were inclined to vote for her got scared off. In fact, that was their strategy, wasn't it? To concentrate on the people who were inclined to vote for her rather than try to convince people who started out as Trump supporters and bring them over to the other side.
It's true. It's a running motif in the book that that the Clinton campaign basically turned away from trying to persuade people who were on the fence or even leaning against her to vote for her, and rather decided that they should expend as many of their resources as possible, including where they sent the candidates and their advertising, things like that, on trying to get people who already agreed with her to show up. So, you know, the analysis that she was damaged by people who were supportive of her not coming out would, you know, indicate that it really, you know, that these things really hurt her strategy. I think her explanation of what happened is incomplete. The big American public polling association recently came out and said that you really can't prove that the Comey letter did this. As Amy and I report in the book, the Republicans were already seeing trends moving upward in some of these key battleground states. We had interviews, a couple of days before the Comey letter came out, where Republicans were talking about upticks in these battleground states. So there was already some movement going on there. I also think that, you know, if you look at Jim Comey coming out and saying that he was reopening the investigation on October 28th, that may well have had an effect on some voters. However, had she not put done the private server thing in the first place, Jim Comey wouldn't have had her fate in his hands. He wouldn't have been able to come out and condemn her as he decided against recommending a prosecution because he wouldn't have been investigating her. The reopening of an investigation wouldn't have happened. And as far as Russia goes, it's hard to know exactly what effect Russia had on the election, except, you know, we knew that Russia was attempting to tamper. 17 U.S. intelligence agencies had concluded that Russia was behind the DNC hacks earlier in the year. And Secretary Clinton made that case on the debate stage. I think people will remember she accused Donald Trump of being a Russian puppet. And she made the case about what the intelligence community had found. For people who were listening to the campaign, we didn't know everything we know about Russian engagement at that point, but certainly it was a case that she was making and one she thought would be effective with the American public and was not effective enough for her to be sworn in on Inauguration Day.
And Amy, we have an email here from Tom in Baltimore who says that Secretary Clinton alienated people with her pointedly unpopulist approach, counting on old coalitions to come through and counting on antiquated ways of gauging the sense of the electorate. You talk a lot about the campaign manager of the Clinton campaign, Robbie Mook, and his reliance on analytics and data. Tell us what's the distinction between analytics and polling?
They're very different. They're kind of cousins, but I think one, data and analytics relies. They can basically tell you everything that's happening inside a household and down to magazine subscriptions and very specific things, and basically counts on, or it can give you kind of a formulation on what the likelihood of turnout is for someone or a particular candidate. I think that this was something that Robbie and his team kind of relied on. I talked a little earlier about Bill Clinton and how the feel on the ground was different than what the data analytics was reporting back to them, to this team. And I think that was a big problem for them as well. And that, they could have, John and I talk about this at the end, but they didn't do traditional polling in certain states at the very end and relied specifically on this data that was coming into them. And that hurt them in the end. But I think, to your larger point about the rise in populism, I think that, we have one moment in the book where she is confiding to Secretary Clinton is on an airplane and she is confiding to a confidant, a longtime aide, Mignon Moore, about basically the feel in the country and that she can't quite wrap her arms around what's happening. And I think that was a very poignant scene because it basically spoke about what was going on, obviously, inside her head and what she was feeling about, the large crowds that were coming out for Bernie and what she was seeing on the other side as well.
And John Allen, there seems to be a good bit of discord and disagreement between the campaign chairman, John Podesta, who, of course, took front and center when his emails were splattered all over the headlines for weeks at a time, and Robbie Mook, the campaign manager. What were the two portfolios there? What's the difference between a campaign chairman and a campaign manager? And you report that they were at each other's throats and at one point just they'd stop talking to each other even. How much of a factor was that in terms of running this massive organization? They certainly had a lot more people working for them, in terms of the numbers of bodies employed by the campaign than the Trump campaign or the Sanders campaign.
Tom, you asked the perfect question. What are the writs of these two folks with these similar sounding titles? And this was confusing for people in the Clinton campaign, for much of the campaign, well into 2016. Mook had operational control over the budget, over the data analytics team, over the delegate operation. Podesta was there to talk to donors, to do some troubleshooting, to work with the message folks, the communications team, that sort of aspect, to be a liaison with the rest of Clinton world, meaning the Clinton Foundation people, and to some extent the Obama White House where he had worked. But the lines of authority were not very clear, and that created problems, especially because Podesta and Mook had just very different operating styles. In fact, there was a meeting called in about June of 2016, a senior staff leadership retreat, and they were trying to resolve for the rest of the folks on the campaign and the senior leadership what the roles of Robbie Mook and John Podesta were. So you're well over a year into this campaign, and they're still trying to explain this as we go through in the book. This sort of dramatic moment where John Podesta tells the top leadership of the campaign that Robbie is passive-aggressive, and he was very frustrated that he thought Mook was withholding information from him, important information, to be able to make judgments about the allocation of the campaign's resources and things like that. Mook felt like Podesta was absent too much, that he'd jump into issues and out of them. He had sort of an old school style. He could be very abrasive. He would call Robbie names. And as Podesta described himself in that moment with the senior leadership, he said, "Robbie's passive-aggressive and I'm just aggressive." That was a problem all along. And when Secretary Clinton decided that it wasn't working particularly well, instead of giving one person control over everything, she actually made a sort of board of directors, as we report for the first time, called the Super Six, on which both Podesta and Mook sat. Rather than streamlining, she sort of, made this sort of, like I said, like a board of directors.
And Amy, one of the things that fascinated me was the arguments they had about the allocation of resources. Obviously, allocation of resources is a fundamental strategic dimension of any political campaign. But they did not have a 50-state strategy. You write about the fact that there were plenty of states where they didn't even have an office, and there were people who had not organized volunteers and gotten people on the ground. During the primaries, the Sanders campaign had people in all of these states when sometimes the Clintons did not. What and Robbie Mook seemed to be very concerned about running out of money all the time. Yet the notion that I had during the campaign, at least, was that there were so many people on the left who were viscerally terrified at the notion of a Trump presidency that they were more than willing to support Secretary Clinton's campaign, and they were certainly supporting, particularly smaller donors, supporting Bernie Sanders' campaign. But why were they so concerned about money? It seemed like they had plenty, and they certainly had a staff that was gigantic.
Yeah, that's true. And that was a question that we sought to answer in this book. And, you know, we tell stories about battleground states and how certain people felt. One person told us that they were being sent into war without armor, in these battleground states, they didn't feel like they had what they needed. Something as simple as lawn signs. Like, people would call campaign offices around the state and ask for lawn signs, and they couldn't find them. And so this was a strategy that they took on very early on. And I think it hurt various states. And you had people like Congresswoman Debbie Dingell in Michigan basically sounding the alarm repeatedly in Michigan, a key state that she lost in the primary and then once again in the general, seeing that they didn't really have what they needed on the ground. And that was just one example. Robbie, for good and bad, was frugal and wanted to, you know, they always felt like they were running out of money. And that was basically why I think in August of 2016, you saw Secretary Clinton kind of disappear from public campaigning and why she spent so much time fundraising, because there was always this fear that money was short.
John, do you think there's any evidence? We've got a couple of callers who are asking essentially this question, that Bernie Sanders would have been a stronger candidate in the general election than Donald Trump, or that Joe Biden would have prevailed over Donald Trump instead of Hillary Clinton. Is there any notion in the political punditry class or the folks who study this and folks like you and Amy who report on this year in and year out? Does anybody have any reason to believe that had there been a different candidate, we would have had a different outcome?
It's impossible to know without running the race, because you don't see what the arguments for and against the candidates are. You don't get to size them up on the same stage against each other. And so I think it's very difficult to know. And obviously, people would like to, you know, compare Willie Mays and Babe Ruth and get those sort of those contrasts. But, I would say this, that Bernie Sanders ran and lost in the Democratic primary. He had weaknesses as a candidate that Secretary Clinton was able to expose, or that voters within the Democratic primary process and certainly the superdelegates chose not to go with him. Vice President Biden chose not to run. I think good, healthy, competitive primaries in each party are probably something we're going to see more of over the future, you know, over the course of time. And winning is a good symbol of your potential for success.
It will be fascinating to see what the next Democrat and Republican candidates learn from this reporting and learn as they study this campaign, as candidates are wont to do when they start thinking about becoming president. So thank you very much for this great reporting, this wonderful and insightful and interesting book, and for your time this afternoon. I appreciate it.
It was our pleasure. Thank you.
Amy Parnes is the senior White House correspondent for The Hill newspaper. Jonathan Allen is the head of community and content for Sidewire and a columnist for Roll Call. Their book is called Shattered: Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. That'll do it for us today. Tomorrow, conversation about net neutrality and laws governing the Internet, plus the unwritten laws of human behavior that also appear to dictate what we share and what we hide when we go online. That's coming up on the Tuesday edition of Midday. Thanks to WBGO Radio in Newark, New Jersey, and our colleagues at NPR in Washington for their help today. And thanks to The Diz for supplying lunch. They're located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. And thanks, of course, to you for tuning in today on the radio or online. We'll be back with you tomorrow. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.